Our next speaker this morning is going to be Brandy Toner, who is one of our speakers who probably had to travel the least amount of distance to get here. She just had to walk down the hill. She's going to talk to us today on state-of-the-science tools for measuring arsenic speciation in glacial sediments.
Good morning. I have the pleasure of being the last speaker before lunch. I hope you're all feeling perky. I'll do my best to keep things moving along. I wanted to give you some sense of what you're getting into when you're hearing a talk from me. I'm an assistant professor. I'm only about halfway toward tenure. And my group is really young. And so I'm going to talk today about a problem that most of you are familiar with. It's an old problem, arsenic in groundwater in Minnesota. I, however, am new to this question, and I'm bringing a new perspective that I hope that you'll find useful. This is the kind of research that cannot be done very effectively by one research group. So we tend to work in a large collaborative team. Some of the folks that are on the slide that are listed on the slide are here today. I can credit Mindy Erickson at the USGS for getting me involved in arsenic research, pretty much my first semester here at the University of Minnesota. In addition, I collaborate with Jim Berg and have had lots of conversations with Rich Suley, and the Minnesota Geologic Survey has turned out to be a really important partner for this research in terms of leveraging resources. It's really expensive to drill rotary sonic cores. So we've been working very closely with them to try to get this research done. My group in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate, again, is a young group, but I've been really lucky to have some pretty talented and motivated students, both at the graduate and undergraduate level, working on this project. And so the person that you want to be thinking about is Sarah Nicholas. She's there in the anaerobic chamber. You'll see a picture of her outside of the chamber. Of course, there is oxygen present. She's cleaning it. We have an undergrad here, Sarah Baldwins, who's a chemistry student who's been working with us from the very beginning. Lindsay Briscoe was my laboratory manager for my first 2 years here on campus. She was very essential in working with Mindy and I in developing this project. This picture here is my team up at the Core Archive Facility in Hibbing, Minnesota. So, what do? I work with geochemists, geologists, glacial geologists, hydrogeologists. I like to think of myself as a geologist in training. But what I really have expertise in is metal speciation in environmental systems. I'm an environmental chemist or environmental geochemist. And when I talk about speciation, this is what I'm thinking of. What is the exact suite of chemical forms of an element present in the system of interest? Okay? Means that our group thinks about the concentration, distribution, and bioavailability of metals in natural systems. We come at this from what we call a molecular level approach because we want to be able to ultimately talk about the speciation of arsenic in this case. We want to be able to identify mechanisms of reactions, and we use primarily spectroscopy and a lot of other mineralogical and material science techniques to do this kind of work. Just to get your surface chemistry hats on, just to remind you, if we're talking about speciation, those could be aqueous complexes or aqueous species. They could be adsorbed to minerals, they could be precipitates, or they could be impurities in existing minerals. All of these species, for almost every redox-sensitive element of interest, but particularly arsenic, are sensitive to mineral surface reactions and microbial activity. Our team does not currently have a microbiologist. So, if you find this interesting, and you are a microbiologist, you should come talk to us. Okay, so here's what we're going to try to accomplish before lunch. I'm going to remind you that arsenic in domestic well water is a problem in Minnesota. I think everyone here knows that, so I'm not going to belabor that point. Arsenic is a naturally occurring trace element. So this is a trace element that is a contaminant, health problem. In glacial sediments in Minnesota, we see values usually less than 10 milligrams of arsenic per kilogram in the samples that we've been working on. The crustal average is a little under 2. So we do have an enrichment, but it's a small enrichment. That's part of the paradox, the arsenic paradox. And based on Mindy Erickson's dissertation work, we know that elevated arsenic concentrations in well water are correlated with certain glacial deposits, and they are also correlated with specific kinds of well construction and well placement. We'll talk a little bit about that as we go. One of the things that I'm interested in is identifying the mineral phases that host arsenic, because they are not well known. We have some key primary suspects, but I would say that by and large, those have not been pinned down to my satisfaction. And we're also curious, as a team, in trying to figure out if all of the stratigraphy information, all of the great hydrogeological mapping and stratigraphy that's been done for the state of Minnesota correlates or corresponds directly to the geochemical or mineralogical composition of those strata. This is important. If we want to be able to map arsenic distribution in the subsurface, if we want to be able to predict or understand to some degree of certainty where one would find arsenic elevated in groundwaters, we need to answer this question. And I would say that's an open question at this point, which I'm relying very heavily on Minnesota Geological Survey and their glacial geologists to help me with that part. So, the upshot of this talk is I propose that we start at the beginning. Let's talk about the mineralogy in the sediments. Let's talk about the phases that host the arsenic. All right, arsenic. One of those unique elements in which you have both trace elemental abundances as well as enough present to cause human health issues. So drinking water is the primary exposure route. It is known that arsenic concentrations in water from about 10 to 50 micrograms per liter increase your risk of a variety of nasty cancers. We know that's no good. And the US EPA has a definition for elevated arsenic concentrations, which would be greater than 10 micrograms per liter. It's a pretty low concentration. You might imagine it would be easy in Minnesota to exceed that in a domestic well, and it happens quite often. Okay, so here's what we think we know. Arsenic-bearing glacial sediments correspond with the Des Moines lobe till, so there's a geographic correlation of high arsenic or elevated arsenic wells in these this particular geographic and geomorphological region of the state. We can thank a number of people for hammering down that, but particularly Mindy Erickson with her work, and Carrie Jennings is contributing a lot to understanding how the ice streams have deposited material over the state of Minnesota over time. We know that there are risk factors, including well screen placement and construction. So if you choose to have a short well screen, and you choose to place it near the contact between a glacial till and a sand and gravel aquifer, you have a statistically higher chance of finding elevated arsenic in your groundwater, in your well water, I should say, as opposed to a longer screen that's placed further away from the contact. Again, this is Mindy Erickson's work. I told you it was her fault that I got into this. So, we have arsenic in the glacial sediments in Minnesota. They correspond to a fairly defined geographic region of the state. We have risk factors like well screen proximity to glacial contacts, but there's still this nagging question. Notice a lot of the work that Mindy did was published in 2005. There's still arsenic in well water in Minnesota. There's still arsenic in well water for new wells that are drilled in Minnesota. So this is not a problem that has gone away with our improved understanding of the correlations of where high arsenic wells might be located. So what's the problem? My perspective would be that the problem is complexity and heterogeneity in the deposits. And what we see is this enigmatic relationship between arsenic in well water. Wells in close geographic proximity can have very different arsenic concentrations in the aqueous phase. Even wells in close proximity with similar depth can have very different arsenic concentrations. And even sometimes when you have well water with very similar aqueous geochemical properties, you can still have really different arsenic concentrations. Hey, that's complicated. Not exactly what we would expect. The other source of heterogeneity is that the Des Moines Lobe tills represent a group of deposits that hail from different geographic regions over time. They are not a uniform, geochemically, they are not a uniform group of deposits. So we have variable source materials, and not all the strata in the Des Moines Lobe result in well water concentrations that are elevated in arsenic. So this is a problem. And then we can make the observation that there are tills in Minnesota that are not part of the Des Moines Lobe, or that are older tills that do contribute arsenic. So we have all of these pieces of information that result in complexity and heterogeneity across the landscape at the surface as well as with depth. So what are the open questions? These are my questions and our team's questions. Which formations, which geologic strata, are the source of arsenic? And in particular, what are the primary mineral phases that are hosting the arsenic? If the source of arsenic to these systems is indeed a solid phase mineral, well, what are they? I mean, that seems to be the good place to start. And do stratigraphy and geochemistry correspond in the formations? If I had to put money down on it right now, I don't even know which way I would go. I'm certainly hoping that they do, because that's our one chance, I think, to be able to map them out to any degree. And, you know, the big question, do we have any chance to predict arsenic vulnerability for wells in west central Minnesota? So that's our focused question. It's a bit pie in the sky now that I've been working in this field for just a little bit longer, but I'm not ready to give up on that yet. Okay, so here's what I propose. My group has a different set of skills than have been applied to the system previously. All evidence at this point points toward the source of arsenic to the groundwater being naturally occurring minerals. So why don't we shift our focus a little bit from the aqueous phase, which is, of course, where human consumption of arsenic happens. It's natural to focus on that. But I think that if we were to shift our focus, or just some of us were to shift our focus to the solid phase, perhaps we could get a foothold in the question. And what we would like to do is just to start by identifying the sources of arsenic in the solid phase. So, just in case I didn't have your attention yet when I talked about speciation, let's just say it again. Solid phase speciation means that a single element can have multiple chemical forms in a natural system. It's just the truth. The exact chemical form or speciation determines its behavior in the environment. So what is speciation? It could be valence state. It could be local coordination environment. It could be the exact mineral phase present. So what I know how to do is make measurements of solid phase metal speciation. And this works beautifully for arsenic, although we didn't know for sure if it was going to at the outset. So part of this presentation today is just to give you a progress report to tell you that indeed we can make these measurements and it looks very promising. So we do two things. We do synchrotron radiation, X-ray absorption spectroscopy. I'm going to describe that briefly because it is just before lunch. We don't want to get too much into the details. And the more classic approach is we do sequential extractions. We pair these two methods because sequential extractions allows us to get after the 1,000-odd samples that we have already collected to date. Yes, the grad students have been busy. We can't make X-ray absorption spectroscopy measurements for 1,000 samples. It's just not possible. So we use the sequential extractions as a high-throughput method, which is still very laborious, and then we use X-ray absorption spectroscopy to go in and make really detailed measurements about the exact mineralogy and form of arsenic present in the materials. The glacial sediments that we look at fall into three sort of basic categories. We try to look at samples that represent the sand and gravel aquifers. We also look at what we call here the confining layers of the tills, right? The low porosity electron donor-rich strata. And because Mindy identified that wells located with their screen at that interface have a higher chance of having dissolved arsenic concentrations that are elevated, we pay a lot of attention to what we call these contacts. Okay, so X-ray absorption spectroscopy. How many have you used it? Can I see a show of hands? How many of you have collaborators that use it? A few, okay, all right. So it has some really strong advantages for natural systems. So let's just reel through that real quickly. One, it's elementally specific. What that means is I can take my glacial till sample and I can tune my X-rays to the arsenic absorption energy and ask only arsenic what its speciation is, ignoring iron and carbon and sulfur and all of these other things. So it's got tunnel vision. We can look at just arsenic and we don't have to strip away or dissolve or remove or change the speciation of the sample. So this is very important. It's sensitive to valence states, so arsenic 3 versus arsenic 5, for example. It's sensitive to local bonding environment. That means if arsenic is an impurity in a pyrite mineral, we should be able to measure that. So this is important for our system. We have choices in spatial resolution, which for these complex materials turns out to be really important. We have landscape scale heterogeneity. We've established that. But if you start to look at these materials with a microscope or a microprobe, what you see is we have microscale chemical heterogeneity. That's difficult to deal with, and you'll see from the data that I'll show in just a few minutes what I mean by that. And we can make these measurements under environmentally relevant conditions. So what does that mean? Ambient pressure, temperature can be cold, you can heat it up. There can be water, no water. These are your choices. If you want to take a till from the core archive, go over to the synchrotron and throw it in the beam, that's your prerogative. You can do that. And it's a really flexible sampling platform. Which there are some examples of tills from the archive barn. Where do you get X-rays? So you get X-rays at synchrotron facilities. These are electron accelerator storage rings. When you take an electron beam that's moving near the speed of light and you bend it with a magnet, it releases X-rays. We use those X-rays to do the spectroscopic measurements. This is just a photograph that I really like because it's looking over the shoulder of the synchrotron facility down to the San Francisco Bay Area. So I did my dissertation at Berkeley. I get to travel, I have the great luxury of traveling back to Berkeley many times a year to do this kind of research because you can't have your own synchrotron. I don't know that you ever will be able to, so we all have to share with the Department of Energy. Thank you, taxpayers, for supporting my research. I also go to Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois because they also have a state of the science facility there where we can make some pretty nice measurements. And I'm going to show you data both from Argonne and Berkeley when we get to it. So here's where we get to talk about the samples. So we have in my laboratory at this point two kinds of samples. We have archive rotary sonic drill cores that we got from the Hibbing archive. We chose those samples with the help from MGS, especially Alan Knabley. Really took us under his wing early on and helped us identify cores that would be useful for the questions that we wanted to ask. And we got a lot of help at the facility. You have to actually go with a forklift and get these little core coffins, they look, you know, pine box coffins, and bring them down on a pallet. It's really a lot of work. So we got a lot of really great help from them. And then we've had the great pleasure of participating in new drilling activities, both winter 2010 and Sarah Nicholas, the PhD student who's on this project, is probably out collecting core now. I think she's in Clay County. So the archive cores were collected in this region where it's red. The winter cores, yes, we were coring in January in Minnesota. We're south central Minnesota. We had a long list that Alan, as I mentioned, helped us assemble. You can see this is west central Minnesota. We were able to, in the 2 days that we were at the core archive, sample 10 cores successfully. So 10 cores, 250 samples. Here's Sarah. She's out of the glove box and looking happy. Those are the counties represented for the cores that we collected. It turns out that part-time jobs are really important for graduate students. That's Ryan. He had worked at Menards. He knows how to run a forklift. He was awesome in the barn. I mean, he's a very great scientific mind as well, but this turned out to be something very useful, so we worked on it as a team. Sample set number 2. So these are fresh materials. In contrast to the archive cores, right, that were stored at, well, ambient Minnesota temperature in the barn over many years, decade or something on that order, dried in exposure to oxygen, what you should be thinking is, dread, this could be really bad for arsenic speciation. This is also something that we've been really concerned with, but I think you'll be pleased with the results that we find. But to deal with that sense of dread about how arsenic speciation is going to change with core storage, we sampled 10 fresh cores, and we got 400 odd samples. This was really difficult field conditions. This is the ice tent that we purchased to be our in-the-field laboratory. It blew down. Here's Sarah and Alan and Gary Meyer trying to, in the field, understand what the core had to say so Sarah could sample it and then immediately package it under argon. So we wanted to package it under an inert gas and then freeze it. The freezing part was easy, as you might imagine, in the field on this day. It was really hard work, and Sarah really has earned her PhD with that effort. So let's talk a little bit about the measurements so that I can show you some data before we go to lunch. I'm going to tell you about two quote-unquote useful tools, and these are both synchrotron measurements. This happens to be what we call the instrument hutch. This is in Argonne National Lab. Sarah's up on the instrument table, feeding our sample into a cryostat. Arsenic is a very redox label element. It can change oxidation state during the measurements, so what we were doing was keeping them very, very cold during the measurement, which preserves the speciation, very important. Postdoc Shahida, who's now living in Toronto. So again, we had our glacial sediments, aquifer, confining layer, and interfaces, and we had a basic question. Can we make good spectroscopic measurements on materials with exceedingly low arsenic concentration in the solid phase? Now, for some of you geochemists, you're going to think, well, it's not that low. But for spectroscopy, it is. And the convention in my field is low would be 100 or 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. So we're really pushing the detection limit of this approach. So we just wanted to ask the question, for the TILs that we had in the range of 4 to 10 milligrams per kilogram, could we make a good measurement? And the answer was yes, but we had to ratchet back our expectations a little bit. Mostly that we were able to collect Zane's spectra, which tell us about valence state, and I'm going to explain that in a moment. EXAF's measurements, which help you understand local coordination environment, require a much bigger signal. We're still trying to figure out if we can make those measurements or not. So this is what the data looks like. These are X-ray absorption near edge structure, so Zanes, maybe you've heard that said before, spectroscopy. The results are, yes, we can detect arsenic as low as 4 milligrams of arsenic per kilogram. In those samples, despite our best efforts to physically homogenize the till before the measurement, we still see spatial heterogeneity in the chemical signature of arsenic. And to our delight, the reduced arsenic phases that we would hypothesize should be present in some of these tills are indeed still there after storage. So the archive cores are still looking like a pretty good option for getting a lot of information. Those cores were used then to make hydrogeology and stratigraphy maps. It's a whole network of information that we can tap into if we can convince ourselves that these are valid measurements of arsenic speciation. Just to orient yourself, these are Zane spectra. The top here, I think, is probably the most important thing for you to look at. What you see is that arsenate, arsenite, and orpiment and arsenopyrite. What we get is a peak distinguishing feature that tells you about the oxidation state or valence state of the arsenic. So that's the kind of first cut speciation information we can get. We can tell you what the valence state of the arsenic is in. All right. But we're seeing spatial heterogeneity even when we're trying to get a bulk measurement, which tells us that we should probably use the right tool for the measurement and go to a microprobe. So this is not a glacial till, but this is one reliably an image that shows up well. So I'm going to use this to illustrate the concept, and then I'm going to show you the mushy, weak signal that we get from the tills. Excuse me. So this is how it works. It's a microprobe XAS. If you've ever done electron microprobe or any of those kinds of measurements, this is analogous in many ways. What I show here is an X-ray fluorescence map. Notice the scale bar. The whole width of the image is 4 millimeters. This is a control. Arsenic would be in red, iron in green, calcium in blue. We call these a tricolor X-ray fluorescence map. It's going to show you where the elements are. It's basically a microscopic image of the elemental composition of your material. Below is an arsenic-treated flow-through column material. This is a permeable reactive barrier question, but I just like this image because it's very aesthetically pleasing, and it's easy to see here where you have a combination of red and yellows. That means you have arsenic and iron co-located. It doesn't tell you how they're co-located. It just tells you they're physically in the same place. So we use this kind of information with the tills to look for where the arsenic is, look at what elements it's co-located with, make an arsenic measurement, and then we ask, what is the mineral form that's hosting that arsenic with X-ray diffraction? And these are all microprobe measurements, and it's a beautiful world-class instrument that I use at Berkeley. It's one of the best in the world. And a lot of people are building them right now across the globe because they are so good for environmental questions. All of these numbers represent places where arsenic or iron spectroscopy measurements were made. It just tells us what the valence state of that element of interest is. So, yes, the projector's quite good here. This is good. So this is an example of what we see for X-ray fluorescence measurements for a glacial till. This large bicolor map, sulfur is in green, arsenic is in blue. If you want to get some sense of the distribution of particles represented in this area, notice the scale bar is 300 micron, you can see the calcium, sulfur, and potassium distribution, right? There's a lot of particles in there. There's a lot of quartz and feldspars and interesting things. That's not where the arsenic is, of course. But it gives you some sense of how many particles we're querying. Here's the distribution of iron. Iron and arsenic, as you might expect, are very closely correlated in the till materials. Here's the distribution of arsenic. What you should notice is that it's not uniformly distributed over the particles. I bet most of you who have been interested in arsenic over time knew that by gut instinct, that probably that was the case. There's going to be little nuggets of minerals that are rich in arsenic, but the bulk average is low. Okay, these are these little micron hotspots of arsenic. And in some cases, they're correlated with sulfur. A lot, in most cases, they're correlated with iron. Okay, so then if we go to each of those locations on the map where arsenic was present on the particle, we collect an arsenic spectrum. This is what those data look like. For the most part, unless you are a spectroscopist who's worked on arsenic, this is difficult to digest in a talk, but I like to put it up because every once in a while there's someone in the group who would like to see the data quality. So that's the purpose of that. But what I would like to tell you most importantly is that the microprobe approach improves the quality of the data dramatically. And the reason why is because you're looking at a concentrated spot, right? You're getting a nugget effect where you can go in and make a measurement on a relatively concentrated spot. This means that ultimately arsenic XAFs may be achievable for us, which is important to me. And then what we've proved to ourselves is that we have the capability to collect the samples, collect the data, such that we can unravel the mineralogy of the arsenic-bearing phases. This is really exciting. We can do this. And I just want to give you some sense of how we might report this data if we're not looking at spectra. This is the kind of information that may end up being useful to some of you in the future if you're studying arsenic. So here I'm showing the proportion of arsenic valence states for two different cores, two different levels. Keep in mind, we're just beginning. This is really the proof of concept stage. So maybe if I can come back and talk to you in a couple of years, we'll get the full meal deal. But right now, it's just proving that this works. So for core number one, what we see is a large proportion of the arsenic is in the plus five state. A lot of that is, as you might expect, adsorbed arsenate. Okay. We also see a small proportion of arsenic 3. In this sample, I believe that was mostly arsenite. So in the archive cores, we can still see the arsenite signal if it was present. That doesn't mean it hasn't changed from the original time in which the core was drilled, but it just means that we can actually get after this question. The arsenite is a labile species, and perhaps we wouldn't expect it to be retained, but we do see it. And then we see a lot of reduced arsenic. What we think this is probably associated with iron sulfide minerals. But we have the mineralogy. I don't have to hypothesize for very much longer. We just have to analyze the data. So stay tuned. This is a different core, a different different depth. What it shows you is that we find a slightly different distribution, but that we indeed can distinguish arsenic 5 and arsenic 3 and reduced arsenic, minus 1 nominally. We can get quantitative proportions of arsenic, because we always measure the total. We can compare these pieces of information to sequential extractions, and then we can put it into our GIS database. And we can use it as data for trying to understand better the distribution of elevated arsenic wells in Minnesota. But we're not satisfied, right? You always want to push it just a little bit further. And so one thing that we tried recently, in a recent visit, is to improve sample coverage. Everybody knows that if you're using a microscopic technique, good representative coverage, good statistics can be a problem, right? This is something that we're aware of. Once we were able to demonstrate we could actually make the measurements, now we're trying to figure out what's the most responsible sampling regime for these kinds of measurements using the microprobe. And so far what I've described to you is basically a point-by-point approach. We do an XRF map, and then we take our probe and we say, what's the arsenic form there? What's the arsenic form over here? And then we just come up with some general picture. To make it more quantitative, we would really want to ask, where's the arsenic in the whole field of view, right? To get around, to get some better statistics. And to do that, we're doing something called chemical mapping, which in principle will give us pixel by pixel readout of the valence state of the arsenic in the region of interest. So this is really going to improve our statistics, and it really is a quantitative method once you achieve this. So that's our next step. We're working on that. So I always like to end early, especially before lunch. So I'm going to wrap this up. Here are the conclusions. Using arsenic XAS, we can identify and quantify the arsenic valence states in archive tills, within the solid phase, right? And we're seeing a distribution that you might expect. So those signatures are not being erased when the cores are being stored. They might be altered, and that's the next step. How are they being altered? We also know that the detection limit is appropriate for trace arsenic in the solid phase. That's great. My colleagues will be really interested in seeing us push this technique. The archived rotary sonic cores are really valuable. They've been worked on by a lot of different talented scientists. That information has been synthesized and made into maps. It's been published in reports. If we can go back and look at the information in these cores, we have the amount of money it would take me, the size of the grant I would have to write to get this kind of context for the samples is unimaginable to me at this point. So this is really valuable. And of course, we have a lot of work to do. We've got about 1,000 samples, and we're just really gearing up to plug through these. Because what we want to do is not prove that we can make a measurement, right? We want to answer a research question, and we want to integrate the measurements that we can make into the existing information that has been invested in by lots of researchers over the last almost 2 decades. And so we're going to, for all samples, we're going to conduct the sequential extractions. For a subset of those, we will conduct the XAS measurements that I just described. We're going to add that information to a GIS database that we've been working on in my group, and that with Jim Berg, we've got a really rich database now. We're interested in going further with the geospatial analysis that Mindy Erickson began in her dissertation work. And we want to map out arsenic speciation in the subsurface. So, I'm an assistant professor. I'm allowed to dream, right? So, dream number one. In the subsurface, we would like to see arsenic speciation mapped alongside stratigraphy. Okay, so we can make the most of those previous investments in the subsurface. Dream number two. Arsenic vulnerability maps for certain regions of Minnesota. Wouldn't that be neat if we could get a better handle on where to place wells to get high-quality drinking water? I would like to acknowledge one bit of funding that Mindy Erickson and I were able to get from the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs. They supported this work early. Sarah Nicholas's stipend was supported by them last year. And I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Brandon?
I don't know about businesses specifically, unless you count agricultural businesses, right? So farms for which my understanding is sometimes the arsenic concentration in the well water doesn't allow you to feed it to cattle, for example. But I don't have a lot of good anecdotes on that part, yeah. Because we've been mostly focusing on domestic wells in our analysis so far. We have those samples, and we certainly intend to, especially where there's a till, contact, and sand and gravel continuum. And so we've started with the till because they're the smoking gun and because they tend to have higher bulk concentrations, so it made our first cut feasibility measurements a little bit easier. But we will get to them. And Alan Knavely was very direct on that point, that he thought it would be a huge mistake to neglect those sediments in our analysis.
I think Brandy's going to be around for a little part of the rest of the day, so if anybody has any follow-up questions, track her down. Thanks again, Brandy.
Thank you.